Blog Talk Radio.
Today on Backroom Politics, open private fundraising event, insert foot. Mitt Romney can't seem to get out of his way when he comes to dealing with private fundraisers. Also, can he recover by late-night press conferences? Oh, by the way, President Obama apparently not political enough. He really doesn't want the job, that according to several articles. We'll talk about that. Serious note, last week after we went off the air, serious turmoil in the Middle East. We'll discuss the latest situation in Libya, Yemen, and Egypt. That, and tell me a story today on Backroom Politics. Welcome to a very dreary, ugly, tornado warning Washington, D.C. This is Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. It's a full slate of the roundtable today. Back with us as he is every Tuesday. He is the former 8-term member of Congress from Washington 2nd District, former Vice President of Government Affairs for Burlington Northern Railroad. He is the Honorable Congressman Al Swift. Hello, Congressman.
Hello, Justin.
And folks in Radio Land, you're going to have to excuse me. I am a little bit under the weather, so if I sound a little nasally, it's not your audio settings, it's me. To my 11 o'clock, as he is every Tuesday, he is the longtime Senate staffer, former Undersecretary of Commerce, served under, last count, 4 presidents. He is the very distinguished and very charming fellow from the Simpson Center. He is the Honorable Alan Moore. Hello, Alan.
Hello, Justin, on this dark and dreary, tornado-filled day.
Wow, that was very Edgar Allan Poe-esque, I might add. Thank you. To my 12 o'clock, as he is every Tuesday, he is Wow, way to go, Congressman Al. To my 12 o'clock, he is the former floor chief for Congressman Gerald Ford. He is longtime Washington insider, former vice president of the National Broadcasting Corporation. He is the Honorable Bob Hines. Hello, Bob.
Hi, Justin.
By the way, for those of you listening at colleges, every time we say hello, Bob, you can take a drink. At the 1 o'clock position, he is a longtime Washington insider and former executive director of the Democratic Party of the great state of Maryland. He is the Honorable Carl Tubin. Hi, Carl.
I'd like you to spell the name the way you just pronounced
it. How do you spell hack?
Hello, everybody.
And to my right, after a whirlwind tour of the outer continents, the inner continents, and everywhere abroad, he is the vice president of Eurasia Center for China Affairs. He is a member of the bar in the great state of New York and the District of Columbia. He is Dr. Ralph Winnie. Hello, Ralph. Welcome back.
Thank you. Glad to be back from extensive travels to London, Tampa, and Uzbekistan, just in time for my birthday.
Yes, very good. So, lots to talk about. Let's get to the serious issues first, because after we went off the air last week on September 11th, after a very solemn and kind of almost a national day of reflection on September 11th, news came that in Libya, first of all, in Egypt, in Cairo, there were protests against a film that was posted on YouTube, apparently, by a noted, I'll call it what it is, a noted whack job, who has been on everybody's radar for some time. But because a video was posted on YouTube, it sparked controversy in the Middle East, starting with an assault on the walls of the U.S. Embassy in Cairo. That's where they actually breached the wall, took down the American flag, and put up the flag of the Muslim Brotherhood. No major injuries to Americans or to civilians in Cairo. However, bruised egos all around at the American Embassy. Second of all, in a more serious note, the U.S. ambassador to Libya and his security detail were killed in an RPG attack on the American consulate in Benghazi, a city that is notably pro-American, for a large part. In fact, there are more pro-American people in Benghazi than I would say that there probably are in Paris right now. But it was a strike. No one claimed responsibility to the best of anybody's knowledge, but all sources lead to a combination of Al-Qaeda and influence from the Muslim Brotherhood. Let's get down to it, though. First of all, are we, Alan Moore, are we seeing a reversal of the Arab Spring, do you think?
Well, I don't know if it's a reversal. You may remember that months ago, a long time ago during Arab Spring, we basically said, careful what you wish for, because we knew we were giving up the stable dictators for unstable, unproved democratic leaders. It's obviously very, very fragile, and the reaction to an otherwise just stupid but meaningless in America video prompted us to remember that how fragile things are and how much people basically don't like America.
Carl Toobin.
There's a lot underlying this to, you know, these people, they thought with the Arab Spring, especially in Egypt, they were going to get democracy, and they've got some democracy, but it isn't the democracy that they envisioned at this point. There have been demonstrations in the streets of Egypt before, not against us, but just against the Egypt administration, and there's a lot of pent up frustration in all of these countries who went through the Arab Spring and feel that, geez, we really aren't getting what we wanted. We're not getting the freedom that we wanted. I don't know what they expected, but they're not getting that. Also, there's an element there of, especially in Egypt, that, you know, we helped get rid of Mubarak. We helped these other folks come in. So there's a little bit in each of the facts of, you know, what did the United States do for us? And all that has to come in. Movie came up, I think that kind of coalesced everything into one, and boom, you had all these demonstrations, not only in the three countries that we talked about, but all over the Middle East.
Congressman Al.
I think I completely agree with Carl, but I think it gets more complicated than that. I think that these people, including the forces for democracy in the Mideast, don't know what real democracy is.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so they assume that if this film is run, it is run with the permission and support somehow or other of the government. They can't distinguish. Not only with the United States, a filmmaker in, I think it was Holland, was murdered some years ago because, and then there was the newspaper that ran cartoons of the Ayatollah, and they don't understand that the government here can't tell some kook that you can't say something foolish, idiotic, or even not in the best interests of the country. And certainly, what he did was not in our best interests.
Ralph, it strikes me that, you know, there's talk that it was coincidence that was September 11th. There was talk that, excuse me, that they just needed a reason to pull some of the actions that they pulled. It strikes me that a simple video on YouTube being brought out isn't enough to justify an attempt on particularly a high-ranking U.S. official like the ambassador of Libya and Chris Stevens. Is that accurate? I mean, were they just looking for a reason, or is this enough to spark it?
I think these people hated America anyway, and they were just looking for some sort of excuse to go out and murder Americans. There's no evidence that the U.S. government was behind the promotion of this video. And the worst thing is to blame our country for the actions of some stupid individual.
Alan Moore, when we do look at the actions, particularly what happened as a result of the attack on the U.S. Embassy in Cairo, U.S. State Department issued a statement. It almost sounded like they were placating or apologetic for the video being posted on YouTube. Was that the right response, or was that kowtowing to the Muslim Brotherhood?
Who knows? It obviously wasn't the right response in that they withdrew the statement and the White House distanced itself from it. It also triggered a premature response from the Romney folks, which is redounded to their detriment. But remember, they put this statement out before the demonstration outside the embassy. They were hearing and worrying that something might be amiss, so they were hoping to head it off. It was later in the day that the demonstrators showed up, and it was later in the day after that that Romney decided to jump on what looked a lot like an apology, whether it was or not, and the White House withdrew. They didn't like the language either. By then, by the time all of this came down, we knew of the horrors that had happened in another country, in Libya, in Benghazi, and all of those things got bungled together. So it was, from a U.S. interests standpoint, a very unfortunate series of events, and from a Romney campaign standpoint, a very unfortunate series.
Well, we're going to talk about the Romney reaction here shortly. That in the 47% statement, he's got his own issues. But looking at what's going on in the Middle East, Bob Hines, there's a dramatic sense of tension because after what we saw in Libya and the tragedy involving Ambassador Stevens and his security detail, after what we saw in Egypt, we now start to see we saw. Events starting to rise up in places like Yemen. We even saw it in Australia. We even saw it here domestically where Muslims were rising up in protest. Are we at a breaking point right now, do you think, Bob, where this could either go one way or the other, depending on the actions of one individual, let's say the new president of Egypt?
I don't think that this particular incident is going to break relationships or destroy relationships with the new government of Egypt or Libya or anything else. What we have to understand, whether we like it or not, is that I think Al said it earlier that they don't. So much of the world doesn't understand in America and in the West generally. You have a right to say something, even if it's stupid, even if it's painful.
There's no law against stupidity.
There's no law against saying it. There's a constitutional right to speak. Doesn't mean that you ought to do it. It doesn't mean that some stupid person can't cause an awful lot of trouble, inadvertently or otherwise. But the fact of the matter is, we have a real problem in one sense because we're not in a position. In most cases, to in effect censor somebody from saying anything, but at the other hand, people can say things or do things that are extremely difficult for our foreign policy people to work with.
Carl Toobin.
Matter of fact, there was an interview last night that I saw in the news where the ABC interviewed this one woman in Egypt, and they asked her reaction, and she said, "You have laws in the United States. You ought to pass a law to say that people can't denigrate someone else's religion." And that's that's their whole thing is what we've done, what we supposedly have done, which we haven't as one individual, to use it. The other thing, we kind of got touched on this last week when we were talking about security. And we talked about the internet, and all of a sudden, boom, this thing pops up a few hours later the next day.
Well, and we shouldn't be too surprised because there are Americans who don't understand.
Exactly.
People I can recall a courageous stand taken by Rod Chandler, who was a Republican from my state, when they were trying to pass a law against burning the flag and or desecrating the flag. And most of his Republican colleagues were for it. And I remember him standing in the well of the House, ardently defending the Constitution and the right of free speech, and making himself not particularly popular with his Republican colleagues.
Ralph.
And I think the right of free speech goes the other way. I think the best thing is for people not to upload the video, not to watch it. Do whatever you can to prevent this guy from getting other funding to make movies. You already have some of the actors and actresses coming out and saying, hey, the lines we rehearsed are not what is in this video.
Right.
Do you remember the Dixie Chicks in the early 2000s, one of the top country pop groups? They started making some derogatory comments about George Bush. All of a sudden, people stopped going to their concerts, stopped buying their CDs, and record recording labels would no longer post them. So in effect, they were put out of business.
Yeah.
And this isn't something that can that we should educate people in the Middle East about.
Alan Moore.
This misunderstanding works both ways, obviously. The Arab world, others don't understand America, don't understand democracy, don't understand constitutional rights like free speech. In the meantime, we Americans don't understand the Arab world very well either, not least of all is the fact that it's a really, really narrow group of people in terms of the population of these countries who've engaged in the demonstrations. And there's a big difference between a demonstration that where people shake their fists and get angry and burn a flag or burn a figure in effigy, and people showing up with weapons, breaking in, destroying property, and so on. And our tendency is, I mean, you see this knee-jerk reaction in the Congress. Hey, Egypt doesn't like it? Fine. Cut off their billion-plus dollars, their billions of dollars in U.S. foreign aid. And it's, whoa, wait a minute. Let's have perspective. We want them to have perspective.
But I want to touch on that for a
we
second.
Need some too.
I want to touch on that for a second because it's funny because when you saw President Morsi on Egyptian TV and the translation into English, it almost looked like he saw in the back of his mind, oh, crap, I'm the number two recipient of international foreign aid from the United States. I might not want to poke that sleeping bear. He kind of went, okay, I'm telling everybody, go home. You want to protest? Let's do it at mosque. Let's do it at prayer. Don't go to the embassies. We saw the same thing out of the Libyan government, especially after after the attack and subsequent murder of Ambassador Chris. go ahead.
There was a difference. Libya, right away, the Libyan leadership, you know, right away condemned it and tried to do something. It took a phone call from President Obama to the President of Egypt to tell him, cool it. You don't want to go there. You don't want to do this thing. And that's when he, I don't think he had made a statement before that, but that's when he came up the next day and tried to tone everything down.
Go ahead, Al Moore.
Maybe this whole set of incidents, and we're obviously not finished with them yet, can at least put one myth to bed for good. And the myth is that the world used to hate America and our president. And then with the new president who talked about more humility, less arrogance, a new understanding and outreach to the Muslim world, a whole group of speeches that to many people sounded like an apology, sort of if it sounds like one, looks like one, maybe it is one, maybe it isn't.
The duck argument.
We don't need to argue that point, but the thought was, boy, it's going to be different now. They're going to love us. They don't love us. They didn't love us before Bush. There are people who do, but there are important elements that don't, and they don't understand us. They don't love us. They didn't love us before, and they don't love us now, and they're not going to love us down the road as long as we're the biggest, strongest, most powerful country out there.
Bob Hines, when we take into consideration the fact that, you know, there is a tremendous amount of international aid going to Egypt, but we have a somewhat lukewarm relationship with the new government in President Morsi. Is that enough to make us revisit possibly the foreign aid going to Egypt? Is that enough? or is that enough of a carrot to keep them ahead of the game?
Well, let's step back for a minute and think about Egypt, their place in the Middle East, and the significance. They're one of the few Arab countries that have a treaty with Israel.
Correct.
And that is extremely important from our standpoint. Very, very important. They are a, they have been basically a sounding board for stability, if you will, in the Middle East with their fellow Arabs. And that's a plus, too. Now, the new government, let's face it, the new government is certainly not the old government, and they're probably, I would say, much more to the left, if you will, certainly. The Muslim Brotherhood certainly has that position. So it's likely that we're going to have a different kind of a relationship going forward than we had a year or two ago with Mubarak.
Time for now.
I think there are only two reasons to give foreign aid. One, and it's the lesser one, is humanitarian aid when there are certain kinds of hurricanes and things like that that occur. The other ones are when it's in our best interest. Most foreign aid, and I think a lot of Americans overlook the fact, they think we're just giving away money to be nice guys and to win friends. I think that it's a much more, cynical is the wrong word, it's a much more calculated reason that we help people. And
it's a pragmatic decision.
It's a pragmatic decision, and if you take Egypt, for example, you need to decide what would we be giving up, what would we be losing if we were to cut off the aid. We could be cutting off our nose to spite our face.
But I want to ask this question, though. When you say that, you know, we're not doing it to win friends, I mean, that almost seems like the unwritten mission of organizations like USAID and USTDI.
Let me revise it. We're not trying to be loved. I don't think we're trying to get love out of this. I think we are trying to get cooperation out of this.
Bob Hines.
I think Alice said it well. We're not trying to become buddy-buddy with the population of a particular country when we give them some support. We're doing it because there are reasons that as of state, as we see them, for our own interest or interest of our friends. Let's just take, for example, we're going to cut off everything to Egypt.
Right.
Well, certainly that would cause some problems. And the biggest problem it might cause is what would happen to Israel? Right. What would they do to protect themselves, having no friends in the Arab world because Jordan and Egypt have now backed away because we have cut their aid? And then...
But while all this is going on...
Think about it. Think about the problem of suddenly us starting to worry about getting troops and military equipment into Israel.
But wait a minute. We're also dealing with a situation where... arguably one of our greatest allies in Jordan's King Abdullah, not really proactive in going forward and saying he's got his own problems with the Muslim Brotherhood. We've got a diplomatic corps at the embassy in Beirut burning classified information because they think at any time they're going to get stormed, and we're going to go back to 1980 and 81. Should we not relook at this and say, look, we really don't have a choice? You know, we've got fast teams out there, but at what point do we pull the plug and say, hey, foreign aid was a nice job?
Well,
we've got our own concerns.
Even so, all that may be being true. If there is a point that you pull foreign aid, this sure as hell ain't it.
And Morsi is in a difficult position because he has to balance the needs of the Muslim Brotherhood with the Egyptian military in order to keep the fledgling democracy going. And this issue with Israel is going to play a key role.
Well, Alan Moore, you know, just on the periphery, does the military still have its finger on the pulse of the presidency in Egypt?
Absolutely they do, but, the relationship between the two continues to evolve. But I think the key point here about the U.S., we constantly are looking and reassessing our relationships. And especially ones that cost us a lot of money, or that cost us that where we have defensive presence, defense military presence and are losing lives. But just because we're constantly assessing it doesn't mean that it's ever easy. And I can't see us pulling out of Egypt in the current environment unless a whole bunch of other really horrible things happen, and I hope they don't happen. It's not that we are such a patsy that we will always pay no matter what. But right now, it's very clear.
One would argue that we've done that before, well, i.e. Iraq, i.e. you know, Iran to an extent.
Well, it you know, we can certainly debate it country by country, and you have to do that. You can't just draw big broad conclusions. Every situation is different, just like the situation in Egypt is very different than the situation in Libya. But I think that the point about Egypt, and we've discussed it here, is it is in our interest to continue a relationship where Egypt is financially dependent on us, and for us to pull the plug might make us puff out our chest. But the costs associated with that are likely to be far higher than the cost of the aid.
Carl Tubin.
You know, it's another part of it is the only country at this point where we have a relationship, albeit not the best, with a person of the brotherhood who's head of a country. That's one point. Another point is, that Bob brought up, if we took away foreign aid from Egypt, that treaty with Israel would go by the wayside. And even though they put arms and stuff for Arabs in Israel through tunnels and all into the desert, that would escalate if that were done.
And I think Iran would definitely benefit greatly if we pulled our aid.
I'll tell you who'd really benefit.
Who?
All of our enemies.
Right.
In that part of the world.
Yeah.
You could even argue that they may be motivated to do these things in the hope they can get us to do something.
One thing I do want to clarify, Carl, your comment on President Morsi was good. He is not Muslim Brotherhood. I just want to be clear about that. He is Freedom and Justice Party, which has ties to Muslim Brotherhood, but I don't want to call out I don't want to call out the president of Egypt being associated with, arguably,
Mr. Facts.
Yeah. Oh my God! Look, you've had an influence on me, Alan. I get sick for one day, and all of a sudden, fact check boy. when we now Libya calls into a whole new situation. I want to talk about that, and I also want to talk about the reaction by the federal government. There's now calls for Congress saying, hey, first of all, what happened in Libya never should have happened, and how does the ambassador go out with a light detail to a consulate that has one security person? We're going to talk about that when we get back. This is Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. We'll be back in 3 minutes. Stay with us. Wow, a little bit of Fats Waller, Lulu back in town, and I tell you, when I am back in town, or when any of my friends are back in town, or heck, when we're living here in town, we usually find ourselves down at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., right across from the National Press Club. Why do we come here? Well, they've got the city's best cigar menu, the most diversified, with some of the best-known brands, and some that you might even know, but might want to give it a try. Everything from Arturo Fuentes down to Zeno. You can go all the way from your $9 little petite girly flavored cigars all the way up to the Opus X Cross City. They have a cigar for everybody. Mild, medium, strong, heavy. However you want to smoke it, it's available here at Shelley's Back Room. Come in, have Bob, Na, or any one of the girls show you what the right cigar might be for your taste that evening. Again, Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. As Bob likes to put it, it is definitely the place to be.
You can tell the mailman not to call. I ain't coming home until the fall. And again, I might not get back home at all. Lulu's back in town, yeah. ¶¶ regrets, but it doesn't take me to get around, no. Tell the mailman not to call, he's coming home until the fall. And then again I might not get home at all, soon as back in town. Oh, that woman's back of town, oh my, 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 my.
I heard something. Go ahead.
War of what he called his war of necessity. He called Iraq a war of choice and said, "This is our war of necessity." But
well,
for him,
you know,
this was his war. He took ownership of this war early on, and these things spin out of control.
But you know, when we look at the situation when we are trying to armchair quarterback, you know, I heard a strange comment the other day. That it seems that with all the political chaos happening here in Washington, that the Muslim Brotherhood, the Taliban, Al-Qaeda are taking advantage of the weak political front that we have here in Washington to use it to their political and tactical advantage. Al, does that sound reasonable to you? Does that make sense?
Well, it certainly does make sense. Whether they figured that out or not, I don't know, because they don't understand us. And they don't understand that this country has a way of, if you push that too far, of coming together, possibly even with the Tea Party and what have you. So they need to be careful how far they push that.
Yeah. Bob Lynch.
About a year and a half ago, I remember saying that Afghanistan has not had a stable government since Alexander the Great walked through it. I still think that's the same. They have a very corrupt government. They have tribes that don't like each other for one reason or another. They have internal groups that are trying to take over the place, the Taliban and others. I mean, the place is an absolute disaster. And, you know, the problem that we have is that we don't understand a lot of these different countries and these different people. And they're not, you know, they're perfectly happy to just, you know, instead of fighting among themselves over the drug trade, they're just as happy to fight us. Because they got to fight somebody. They always fight each other, and now they're fighting us. I mean, it's going to go on as long as as we are there, they're going to keep killing us.
So you have to isolate them economically and have some sort of military presence.
There's just nothing you can do.
Congressman Al.
This is a little ridiculous, but I would really like to know what Charlie Wilson, he of Charlie Wilson's War, would say about this. He gave several talks after he was successful in defeating the Russians and all of that, saying that we then mishandled it. And he supported the mishandling. And he had said that he was wrong in doing that, that we should have been building schools and blah, 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 blah. He was not an expert in foreign policy. His expertise was military. But I knew Charlie, and Charlie, for all of his reputation of being kind of a wild man, was in fact a pretty thoughtful guy. And I would love to know what he thought about this mess right now.
Well, you know, Charlie Wilson's, you know, greatest quote, and I'm paraphrasing, was, you know, the Mujahideen had taken down one of the strongest military forces in the history of the world, and we screwed up the end game, basically, in Afghanistan. When, you know, it just seems that we would have learned our lesson a little bit from Charlie Wilson's war in Afghanistan or in any of these Middle Eastern countries. Carl Duvin.
He wanted, he had a whole plan for Afghanistan after they had displaced all these people. And the Appropriations Committee, Clarence Long, said, we've spent enough on your war and we're not going to do that. And things might have been different if Charlie had his way at that time.
But again, armchair quarterbacking, I mean, we can sit there and look at it, but history tells us that there's nothing we could possibly do that is going to change the mentality of the Afghani people and the government of Afghanistan not to be a corrupt, hierarchical, tribal entity with warlords running amok. And that's just the reality. Nobody's been able to do it in 1,000 years. I mean, the Soviets couldn't do it. What makes you think that we're going to be able to do it?
The only thing that the Soviets did relatively effectively is they tried to take Afghans, send them back to Moscow to be educated so that they could be the next generation to lead the country. After we defeated the Russians in Afghanistan, why did we not look at taking Afghanis
and bringing them here
to the U.S., educating them,
no,
sending
them
back?
That screams of brainwashing. There are countries all over the world, but they have no
educated class there. The literacy rate was maybe 5%. And in order to develop a democracy, you're going to have to educate the people and expose them to the West.
You can say the same thing about the Ghana, and the Ghana has no truly literate, but they're not blowing up Americans.
But Ghana is a totally different situation than Afghanistan. Afghanistan is probably the most difficult thing because it is almost ungovernable in any sense that a small D Democrat would agree with. And I don't know what you do about them. And that's the reason. Charlie fought with those people. Charlie lived with those people. Charlie, without having foreign policy expertise, may have understood the Afghanistans better than maybe any other American. And that's the reason I would be interested in what his thoughts were. I don't think he'd have a magic answer. I don't think there is a magic answer.
But out of all the members of Congress before and after him, he's the one member that spent probably the most amount of time in both Pakistan, Afghanistan, and in the Middle East. Would you agree with that, Bob?
Yeah, I think he spent a good bit of time over there, and I think recognized the problem as well as anybody.
But had a legitimate respect and a legitimate love for the people, just could not come up with a way that we could say, all right, we can turn their lives around.
Well, I'm not so sure he loved the people. What I am sure is he was determined to get the Russians out, and he succeeded.
Right. So we're allegations.
I do remember one statement that he made to a small group of former congressmen, and he said, we should have built schools. And then he said several other things, but he particularly sticks in my mind. He said, instead of just leaving, declaring a victory over the Soviet Union and leaving, a policy that he didn't totally oppose at the time. But later he said it was a terrible mistake that we didn't go in there and begin to build something on which they could build stability.
Alan Moore.
It's interesting to reflect now and wonder if Charlie were still around or others who were involved in that as to whether the whole premise of arming a bunch of rebels with state-of-the-art weaponry, ground-to-air missiles that could take out helicopters and heavy-duty rocket grenade launchers and other fairly sophisticated stuff, it drove the Russians crazy, had a huge toll on them, and they eventually left. It would be interesting if we were faced with a similar situation today, whether we would do the same thing. Because in all that's unfolded since then, that flush of, wow, we drove the Russians out, fabulous, and then left nothing behind. Even if we had built schools, I don't know how much difference it would have made. It would have been worth
chaos
trying,
still ruled.
Trying, but chaos might have still ruled. It may be that it wasn't the smartest thing.
Ralph Winnie.
And the problem was when you gave the weapons to a tribe, they didn't always use it against the Russians. They would attack the neighboring tribe that they had a longstanding disagreement with.
Well, we're also dealing with the fact that a lot of these IEDs, a lot of these RPGs are legacy handouts from Charlie Wilson's war, arguably.
And they fell in the hands of the Taliban once they
came. Well, I think that's what he was saying. But I would remind you, we also gave a lot of military aid to Iraq. that we ended up finding pointed at us. And it makes a very difficult choice for us policy-wise. Do you take a person of a country we don't like very much, but who, if we strengthen them, we gain other advantages in a region, and you run the risk that they'll turn on you?
Carl Toobin.
I'm going to ask my friend Alan for some help. In the money that we gave to Afghanistan, Osama bin Laden was there and had part of the information that we were giving, and he started to build from that, I believe.
I'm guessing you're right. He was a Saudi who had some money, so he was kind of self-funded. If you got a bunch of armaments that are available, they're for sale.
Exactly.
Who gets their hands on them? The guy that can afford to buy them.
Right.
So, you know, this is the kind of stuff that happened. I'm guessing that the weapons that set the consulate in Benghazi that killed our ambassador were probably American-made weapons.
Probably.
They were weapons that we or NATO troops supplied to the rebels, helped teach them how to use them. They're still there, and now they're turning them back on us.
Well, we're coming up on the break right now at the top of the hour. When we come back, it'll be happy hour. We're going to turn our focus back domestically and some of the political problems that the Romney campaign is experiencing. Politico today put a headline up, "A Man of Constant Sorrow." There's a lot of sorrow going around the Romney campaign right now. Let's see if he can recover. But we'll talk about that when we get back. This is Backroom Politics Live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street, excuse me, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. We will be back in 4 minutes. Stay with us. You know, here on Backroom Politics, you hear us order drinks during happy hour, the second hour of Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio. But what you don't understand is the quality of the drink that we're getting here at Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Backroom Politics premier sponsor. Hey, you got Dave Hammerly and the bar crew there at Shelley's Backroom that really know how to pour a drink. Whether it's something simple like my on-air Jack Daniels on the rocks with a splash of water, or whether it's something elaborate like what has to be the best martini in the District of Columbia for Congressman Al Swift. Wine selection, scotch selection that will blow your mind. They've got Highland scotches. They've got Isle of Skye scotches, blended, single malt, anything you want. Port wines to go with that great cigar from the great humidor. Down here at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Come on down, have a drink, and make some new friends. Or heck, just come on down and listen to Backroom Politics on Tuesdays.
Time. tried one more once.
Here at Chili's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. I am a slightly under the weather moderator, Justin Russell, and this is Backroom Politics live on Blog Talk Radio. It's happy hour. Congressman Al has been nice enough to order the drinks. I, however, will not be drinking because you shouldn't drink and be sick at the same time. But we'll cut open our cigars, those of us that are smoking. I am not today. And we'll continue the discussion, and we're going to take it back inside the lower 48 and talk about the man of constant sorrow. That being presidential candidate for the GOP, former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney. Mitt Romney's had a really bad week or two. Starting off, well, there's so many places we could start off with, but let's start off with the 47% and work our way backwards. As late as today, this afternoon, Mitt Romney stands by his 47% remark. A remark that has gotten rebuttal from both Republicans and Democrats.
Why don't you remind the people of what
I'm going to do that right now. For those of you who are not familiar with the 47% statement, Governor Mitt Romney was at a GOP fundraiser, high-dollar fundraiser, in Florida, and he said during this fundraiser, and I quote, there are 47% who are with Obama, who are dependent upon government, who believe that they are victims, who believe the government has responsibility to care for them. That has obviously drawn the ire of Democrats all over the place. But there's a lot of Republicans saying, hey, wait a minute, hold the phone here. There's a lot of middle class involved in that, too. First of all, let's look at the Democratic side. For Mitt Romney to say something, which should have been considered off the record. This is a $50,000 a person event down in Boca. Is it wise, Congressman Allen, to believe that at a $50,000 a plate dinner, there's probably some off the recordness in that?
Well, any presidential candidate should assume that everything he does, including pouring cream in his coffee, is on the record. But I have a sense of this. It falls into a couple of things that have got out of the president has said. It reminds me of Trent Lott making his remarks about Strom Thurmond. When you get into one of those things...
Oh, wait a minute. I mean, let's also call it... I mean, Joe Biden's one rolling gaffe after another. There's a lot of effing people here.
Well, exactly. And my point, which you almost blew out of my mind, is that the media gets this and will take when you're addressing a partisan group, there is a tendency to feed them red meat. So both parties tend to fall into the cliches they have been throwing at the other party for years. And everybody in that group agrees and nods, and you get a big applause, and it's fine. And you can talk yourself into a position where you forget that the whole world is listening, and you pay for it. Obama has paid for it. Trent Lott certainly paid for it. And now Mr. Romney is paying for what was a silly remark, but probably went over extremely well with the audience he was talking
to. Let's look at the remark, though. I mean, you know, if you look at the whole remark, he continues to say that these are the 47% who are dependent upon government, who believe that they are victims, who believe that the government has a responsibility to care for them, who believe that they are entitled to health care, to food, to housing, to you name it. That's an entitlement, and that's the government. That the government should give it to him if you're supporting Obama. Bob Hines.
I am going to steal from my friend Alan a fact.
What is that fact?
I suspect where he got the number 47%. That is pretty much the that's the line where people pay. People pay federal income tax, approximately 45-47% of the households don't pay income tax. Why don't they? Because their income is relatively low, and they've got maybe three or four kids, and they've got some children, so they don't pay any income tax. Now that's a different thing than, being on the dole. A lot of these people work at menial jobs. And they're doing the best they can, and they are getting support from the government in one form or another. But the idea of making it sound like they're just sitting in their house and taking federal largesse, I think is unfair.
Well, Alan Moore, basically what he's saying here is that we're creating, and the people that would vote for Obama are ones that believe in an entitlement state. We've created a country of entitlement wannabes. He's not saying anything that hasn't been said by other Republicans, including a lot on the Hill. This is just not the most articulate way to do it.
Well,
is that accurate?
What he said, and I want to build off what Bob said because I completely agree. He jumbled together two facts or three facts. There is the fact, we've made it here numerous times, 47% of the American households pay zero federal income tax. He went on to say, so it's hard to convince them the tax cuts are going to be in any way helpful because you can't cut from zero unless you give refundable credit. So what he then did, though, was took that 47% and applied it in a way that I've never heard it applied before, which is why I think it was accidental and unfortunate and embarrassing and problematic. And that is, he took that 47% and then applied other motives to them. Does Obama in fact have 47% locked up, and are they exclusively 100% those people who don't pay any federal income tax? No. He's got a big base, generally thought to be in the 40-45% range. It includes a lot of those people, many of whom won't vote. It also includes a lot of other people. And by jumbling those numbers together, he came off looking both insensitive and uncaring. He even made the comment somewhere in there that, my job is not to worry about those people. What he meant was, it's not my job to worry about trying to get those people to vote for me because they're not going to.
They're never going to.
But it was a really unfortunate, it occurred back in May and it happened to come out this week. It was just piling on to an already bad week because of the problems in Libya and other problems about what's going on inside the campaign. Bad week.
Bad week. Go ahead, Carl, too.
The other thing, if these people are working, they're paying Social Security taxes, they're paying other taxes, they go out and buy things, they're paying sales taxes. And that might not be federal taxes, but it's money going to the government.
It's a different point, Carl. The notion is, and Romney made the point, how can they support, if they pay no federal income taxes, how can they support federal tax cuts? It's not going to make any sense to them. Yes, they pay payroll taxes because they're going to get Social Security benefits someday. They pay Medicare taxes. They're going to get Medicare someday. They pay sales taxes, as we all do. They contribute to the economy. But in terms of policy, for them, any federal tax cuts are going to make zero sense because they're paying zero federal taxes.
The bottom line is another major stumble for the Romney campaign. They better get back on message or they're going to blow this whole thing. There's no reason that they should not be blowing Obama out of the water, but he's making a lot of these kind of mistakes and giving the impression that he's uncaring and unsensitive.
But this is, Congressman Al, this is not anything we haven't heard out of Republican candidates before. It was just, as he said, not the most elegant stated message he's put out there.
Well, first of all, he's beginning to vibe with the vice president for these kinds of stupid remarks. So I think he needs to be careful.
I think Uncle Joe's got him on a couple of notes, so okay.
I don't know. I, I, I think
well, he's
I
catching up.
He's catching
yeah,
up.
The vice president's been doing it longer.
Well, good point.
No, it's not a good point, but I don't know that it's one we necessarily want to debate right here and now. Let me say something that will cause some controversy. I think in both parties, there are some fundamental beliefs or fundamental expressions or criticisms or statements that they really down deep in their heart believe about the other party, which they wouldn't for a moment try and defend in a rational conversation. I think many Republicans tend to really be disturbed by people who are on the dole, quote unquote. For Democrats, it's a different kind of a situation about all the rich people and what have you. And it's all the more reason that when you're before an audience that wants red meat, you better be careful what you say, because your own biases and your own prejudices tend to come out then, prejudices that you would never defend in an intelligent exchange of ideas.
But we've heard similar rhetoric out of the Obama camp. We've heard similar rhetoric.
I just said that.
No, but what will you let me finish? Jesus. We've heard similar rhetoric.
Oh, you're sick. Why don't you relax?
Okay. Thank you. I mean, we've heard the same rhetoric.
I don't want you to hurt yourself.
No, I'm hurting myself by being here. when we hear the same rhetoric out of both sides, when we see, I mean, this is an old mantra that isn't inherent to just this campaign.
Right.
But now it seems with technology and everything like that, we saw it with Governor, at that time, Senator Allen's Mukaka speech. We've seen it several times with hot mics and hot recording devices. This is just another example. Are we at a point right now where the presidential candidates have got to believe at any given point, unless you're in bed, there's an open mic somewhere? And even then, that's not safe.
Sure.
Bob,
well, of course. You have to expect it. Remember what President Reagan said. We've just, 5 minutes ago, I sent the bombers over to Moscow. It's not quite.
Well, and he had the Cadillac welfare.
He did that to a hot mic.
Yeah, he did that to a hot mic before a presidential radio address.
Exactly. People say stupid things. Al's right. And I think that the idea that you are to say that 47% of the people are basically
deadbeats
who are sponging off the government is an extreme statement. And I don't think I would venture to say that of that 47% of the public, those who are working are paying some taxes, that are, Social Security and Medicare and things like that, and sales taxes. And those who are so unfortunate not to have income except for government how many different programs did this government have to try to help them? So we're doing what we can to help some people. We don't want to have people, that are just really destitute on the streets. So we're trying to help them to keep families together. Nothing wrong with that. You can argue that there are some of them are ineffective and whatnot, true enough. But the fact of the matter is, just to say that he's 47% of the population are more or less deadbeats on the government is a statement that is, unfortunately, nobody could say it.
And I agree with Bob. I think Romney has to come across as empathetic, caring, and compassionate to the average voter in order to win this election. He's not doing that when he makes these kind of ridiculous statements, and he's playing into the Democratic hand that he is someone that is totally out of touch with what's going on in America.
But, again, you're talking about a president who's got over 8% unemployment. Manufacturing jobs have gone down during his presidency here in the U.S. Manufacturing numbers have not seen the rebirth that they were hoping for under stimulus. But this guy continues to maintain a national lead of over 7-8%. Again, it reminds me of the old Saturday Night Live skit of, how am I losing to this guy? with Michael Dukakis and George Bush 41. There's got to be a reason. Now, this leads me to my next point on this, is are these type of mistakes and these type of trip-ups, is this indicative of a campaign infrastructure in trouble? Bob Hines.
Well, I would think the answer to that is there is some problem. I mean, I see it more now. This 47% is a domestic issue, but I see it more in the area of foreign policy, where he doesn't seem to have some of the folks that that might be available, who are experienced and knowledgeable and could help him to understand some of the subtleties and the difficulties and the dangerous points that he's got to watch out for in foreign affairs. And I think he's made some unfortunate statements there.
Well, he's made some other, domestically, he's made some flubs. All kinds of stuff. Alan Moore.
Well, and let's remember that although these comments are fresh, they were made 4 months ago. And that's another reminder that you not only have to be careful, and I think he's become a lot more careful in his in his speaking, because he knows that people are recording, listening, taking notes, spying, doing all of this stuff. Having said that, it's one of those mistakes that he shouldn't have made 4 months ago either, and it came at a very bad time for him.
Go ahead, Carl Tubin.
One of a whole series of mistakes that we talked about. I mean, in the statement about Egypt and what was going on there, an apology and this, that, and the other. when he went to Israel, and when he went to England, had gaffes there that people remember. I mean, all these things are kind of pulling up, and I think it takes a toll on his popularity and his ability from the people's standpoint of, if this guy's going to be this way now, do we really want him as president of the United States as a spokesman for this country?
Congressman Al,
well,
go ahead.
Carl is right. That's why it hurts him, because it raises exactly that question. It's, I think he's going to have a hard time. Not just because of the one remark, but because it kind of fits a line of philosophical comments that he has made over time, and it's tough.
Is this whether it's internal campaign problem? I mean, this week's been a bad week for the GOP overall.
Let me speak to that. This is a campaign that greater than any other campaign says, businessmen know how to do this better than do politicians. And the fact is, they're two different sets of skills. I would hate to see what would happen if a bunch of politicians were trying to run American business, because they don't have those sets of skills. What we're watching is a campaign made up of largely people who think that the business model is what they should be doing, and they're making some terrible mistakes because they don't understand. I mean, first of all, a CEO doesn't have a House and a Senate and two parties and a whole bunch of other things to deal with. In business, you can kind of... it's a pyramid, and you can kind of be the head boss. You can be the dictator, you will, of your company, and therefore your techniques for running it successfully are terribly different than that a politician has to have. So I absolutely reject the argument.
Let me jump in on that
business experience is going to make you a better politician.
But let me,
I think it's going to make you probably harder for you to be a good
politician. But when you say they don't have a House, they don't have a Senate, they've got a general counsel, they have a board of directors, they have shareholders. Shareholders are fickle people. We saw what happened at HP. just because you're CEO does not mean that you'll keep your job necessarily. And they voted out Carly Fiorina.
No, but that's the way to bet. Because in so many instances, the board is in fact appointed by the CEO. And they are beholden to the CEO. And they're loyal to the CEO. And probably that is good for running a business.
But they still have to answer to shareholders, much as members of Congress have to answer to voters.
Yeah. How often... You cited an example of where the shareholders took over. Name me five more.
IBM 1986.
And?
Bob's old company, General Electric, Mr. Six Sigma.
Jack Welch
was inserted into a CEO that wasn't ready to retire at that time. Is that accurate, Bob?
I'm not sure.
Go ahead. All right,
Ralph Woody first, then Al Moore.
Yeah. Well, I think American people.
Then Al with the facts.
Yeah. I think the American people respect and understand Romney's business experience. In fact, that's what his strongest point is right now. It's his inability, though, to be able to connect at a personal level with the American people. The Americans think that he has a better economic plan, but they don't trust Romney, and that's the biggest problem for him right now.
Al Moore looks like he's got a fact.
This is just a personal observation. I get a little nervous when the guy who's describing how business works is Al Swift. and I think back about Romney, and for all of his obvious shortcomings as a politician, and he certainly has some, he is not your traditional businessman. For many years, he worked at Bain Consulting, where you jumped into all kinds of different businesses all the time. Then at Bain Capital, they were trying to turn around companies, take over companies, buy out companies, and he's been out of that business since 1999 when he took over the Winter Olympics in Salt Lake City, which was a major challenge of trying to bring disparate groups together when that thing was about to completely fall on its face. Then, he was governor for 4 years of the state of Massachusetts. That sounds a lot like political experience to me. His problem is not his experience or some blind ignorance of the world of politics. His problem is he's making stumble after stumble in his campaign. And in terms of his plan for the economy, neither he nor Obama have done very much to define exactly what their plan is because they're so afraid that it will turn off voters.
Al Swift.
I want to agree with that, with Alan.
What?
That you would not want Al Swift to be running a company. I don't want Mitt Romney to be running the country.
Well,
you see, and because it's a different skill set.
He was governor for 4 years. How much experience did Barack Obama ever have? He was in a state legislature and lucked in. He was an accidental resident.
But
Romney had a lot of political experience.
He was an accidental senator.
What?
He was an accidental. He ran against Alan Keyes, who was parachuted into Illinois.
But
he had no opposition.
But he has a political skill set that isn't as good as I would like it. He's certainly no Bill Clinton or Ronald Reagan, for that matter. But the idea that 4 years as a governor makes you a politician.
As opposed to 4 years as a U.S. senator and a state senator combined?
I think, Al,
what are you drinking? Because that stuff's going to get your body into trouble, sir.
No, it was that pumice that did it.
I guess so. Wow. You really?
Ferment.
I guess so. All of a sudden, now the alcohol content, that martini and the hummus combined. Al, you mean to tell me that the governor, being the chief executive, and having to deal with two house political system and a two party political system, excuse me, in the state, in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, is less experienced to be the chief executive of the United States than Barack Obama, who pulled 2 years as a state senator in Springfield and 2 years as a U.S. senator, which, by the way, he got, as Bob pointed out so eloquently, by accident. I could have gotten elected senator from Illinois that year.
Oh,
thank God you weren't.
Yeah, thank God.
Justin, you'd then be president.
Yeah,
yeah, oh, my God.
President.
That's right. That's right. You guys fear Chris Christie. Wait till I get a hold of this shit.
And we wouldn't be on the blog radio.
That's right. That's right. True.
I will say it one more time, and then I won't say it again, because it's obviously not being accepted here. I'm sure that there are much more intelligent people listening that may buy
it. Thomas Rinal, don't get the impression that...
I keep talking about skill sets. And I don't think that that when you spent most of your life running businesses and knowing businesses and having supremely that set of skill sets, which you can't take away from it.
Name me one skill set that Obama got coming away as a U.S. senator that Romney did not have as a seated governor of a major economic state.
He worked in community activities.
Community outreach?
Well, Carl
Dubin.
Let me tell you something. All this about Obama's background as 2 years as a state senator and 4 years as a U.S. senator.
It wasn't even 4 years.
Whatever.
It was a full 4 years? All right, I apologize.
But he spent 2 years of it running second president.
2 years was running
Check
president.
Oh, that's right.
Check your facts now.
That's what we have, Alan Moore.
All that is irrelevant. He has now had 3.5, almost 4 years of experience as president of the United States, and he's grown in the job. They criticize his foreign policy and that we went around and we apologized and we did this and that and the other. They were trying to go out and make friends with countries that were antagonistic to at one point.
Who, Carl?
And how's that worked out?
Yeah. Well, I mean, again who were they?
They tried.
What countries?
He and the Secretary of State went around to different countries to patch up relationships that the Bush people had ruined.
All right, Alan Moore.
I'll just say very briefly, it really bothers me that one of the strongest arguments Obama has is that his record in office, even though it is filled with failure, is his strongest argument against somebody who hasn't been president. You get elected for four years, and then you start over again.
Got it for now.
He's not talking about filled with failure. One of the skill sets that Obama does not have is the ability, and it really annoys me, to be able to take credit for what he's done. I mean, I do not understand why the president can't sell the idea that he saved General Motors. Bill Clinton did it in the speech, but Obama can't. So, obviously, there are limitations to
his... But it was a program that was started by the Republican administration.
Except Romney wanted them, let them go bankrupt.
Wait. We can't armchair quarterback that way. If we're going to armchair quarterback it, let's call out, oh, my God, you know I'm sick. Facts! It was the Republicans. It was Hank Paulson that first suggested the bailout.
It was, but Romney...
I want to compliment you on your
even-handed
leading of the discussion. That's okay. please continue bashing Democrats.
I love the fact that we can borrow $50 billion from the Chinese and put it into one industry to completely disorient and distort that industry and call it one of the singular victories of the administration. Hell, we can put $50 billion into anything and prop it up.
Ralph Winnie.
And I think Alan's point, a lot of conservative Republican commentators are saying the key to Romney's victory now is to really attack Obama's foreign policy, with statements like that.
Well, I mean, I would go back and I would say that if anything has been a tremendous success, it has been Obama's foreign policy. Obama has had some foreign policy successes.
Could we run through those?
Absolutely.
But that's the issue.
Absolutely.
What are the successes?
I'll take the successes. The way he handled Libya, I think was with advice from Secretary of Defense. I think that he made the choice. He made a very difficult choice to go into Pakistan, possibly enacting a state of war with Pakistan by violating their sovereign airspace and going in to get Osama bin Laden. I think
even Jimmy Carter would have done that.
Jimmy Carter. Oh my God! Wait a minute, Al. You know I'm sick when I'm defending 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue.
I was about to say that I'm impressed by the way in which you have tried to make this more even-handed in your
called it out on me. Let's take a break because this is great radio. We're going to take a break here. When we come back, we're going to finish this conversation, and we'll go into my favorite part of the story. Tell me a story. This is Backroom Politics Live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., on Blog Talk Radio. Stay with us. You know, you hear us talk about Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. It's being the place to be. America's premier cigar tavern, place to make new friends or visit old friends, or even have a lively political discussion like we do here on Backroom Politics. But what you may not know, Shelley's is the place for private parties. Shelley's Back Room is available to host events for groups of 10 to 250. From cocktail receptions to sit-down dinners, Shelley's can provide custom menu options to suit your needs and budget. Although Shelley's is a smoke-friendly environment, Shelley's can make accommodations for non-smokers based on the size of your party, but heck, why would you want to? With a cigar menu like they have here, why would you even consider going smoke-free? Event pricing varies based on the time of the day of the week chosen for your event. For more information on private parties at Shelley's Back Room, go to www.shelleysbackroom.com/private-party. Shelley's Back Room, the place to be, as Bob likes to say it. It's also the place for private parties. Politics live from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. On a rainy, dreary, tornado-infested District of Columbia Tuesday, we're going to finish up the discussion, because that's great radio, about the presidential campaign, talking about the flubs and the challenges that Mitt Romney has, sparked up some questions by the Honorable Congressman Al Swift, saying that just because you ran a business does not mean that you are qualified to run a country, let alone a superpower.
Absolutely.
Okay, and then at which point the Honorable Alan Moore came back and said, really, because 2 years as a state senator in Springfield, Illinois, and 4 years as a state or a U.S. senator from Illinois, that gives you all the street cred in the world to run a country, let alone a superpower. Did I get that one pretty accurate, Alan?
There's a certain redundancy in what you're saying. We've heard that. Yes, that's, you're absolutely right. That's what he said. That's what I said.
Okay, there's some redundancy. Of course there's redundancy.
You didn't point out that I'm right. You know,
I didn't point out you're right because you're absolutely out of your mind. But Carl Tubin thinks you're right. There's something to that. Bob Hines, be the voice of reason here. I mean, seriously, you've been around politics. You've run several campaigns. You've also been around the corporate culture. I mean, GE wasn't exactly a small business. Help Al understand, please.
Well, let's
not just talking generalities, but let's talk about it. I think the biggest problem that Mr. Romney is having is the fact that he is required to respond rather quickly to reporters who are asking him to respond to issues of foreign policy. He has the kind of a domestic background. Most of his business was in domestic companies, and certainly in Massachusetts he didn't do much foreign policy work. And I think that he's just having a little bit of trouble getting on top of some of the issues. I think that's probably more a failure of the people around him who are supposed to be his advisors on foreign policy. I think it's, you know, I think he probably is being ill-served by those around him who are charged with being advisors on foreign policy issues, because some of the things he has said on foreign policy issues, which in a campaign, you know, you're going to get, you know, things happen overseas and somebody, there's reporters calling you up saying you want to know what's going on. And I just think that he has been ill-served by his own people.
Do you think that's a problem indicative of the campaign, not the candidate?
I think, look, no candidate who hasn't been immune into foreign policy is going to be really good at it. You can't, as I remember, Mr. Obama wasn't that great at the beginning of his campaign last year and on foreign policy. And I think he had some stumbles, too. The fact of the matter is, it's a tough world out there, and you can't just, you know, pop off what you want to say sometimes, because it puts you in a very bad position. And if you are the president or going to be the president, you know, you've got to be able to protect the interests of the country and at the same time make sure that people in the overseas areas that we're dealing with understand where we are and why we're there. And I think, quite frankly, I think he has been ill-served by the people around him.
This has got to bode well for the Democrats, though, Carl Thuman. I mean, but on the flip side of that, Axelrod, Plouffe, and Gibbs haven't been bringing their A game lately. They haven't been getting a message out. They still can't get a message out involving Bill Clinton.
That is one of the real fallbacks of President Obama. And that is, it happened in health care. If he had gone out and controlled health care when it was passed, we might be in a different situation today. And a number of other things, which he hasn't really, he can't project. He welcomed Bill Clinton to come and help him. Clinton did, and I think it's helped him immeasurably among the American people. And he, instead of saying, "Oh no, I don't want Bill Clinton to come and take some of my puff away," I mean, he knew he was in trouble, and he asked Clinton to help him, and Clinton did.
But Carl, if I may, one of the things that shows is that our current president himself has some limitations in this area.
He does.
Right.
Yeah. He does.
And
one of the limitations that there's been a lot of things. One of the limitations that he has when he on January 20th, when he took over as President of the United States, he walked into the White House and he closed the door. Yeah. And he let very few other people outside of his Chicago people come in and advise him, which was a mistake. He hasn't been the best president when it comes to Congress and Democratic Congress in the first 2 years, and Republican House in the second term.
Ralph Winnie.
He's caused himself a lot of trouble because of that.
Ralph Winnie.
And he needs to really connect with the white working class voter, people in middle America, because that's a demographic that has not moved in his favor and keeps the election very competitive. So it'll be very interesting to see how he works with that dynamic.
Okay, Al, Congressman Al.
This is where I think I should say on the air what I said just a moment ago during the break. In my memory, these are two of the worst campaigns I have ever seen for president. And Obama has made a lot of mistakes, and so is the other guy. What's his name?
Governor Romney.
I haven't watched enough television commercials to.
He's the guy you're going to be voting for. I'll just think about it.
Yeah, right. But now I've lost my train of thought.
Oh, so, good, because it's going to be Democratic anyway.
So I'm just going to babble for 10 minutes. You know.
No, your turn. I'll tell you a story is coming up here shortly. Don't worry about that.
Then I can babble.
I have one thing.
Carl Thuvin.
One thing to say. My son, after hearing Romney, what he did foreign policy was concerned, came into my room Saturday morning and said, "Dad," I said, "What?" He says, "I hope the glove keeps talking." I said, "What?" He said, "I hope the glove keeps talking." I said, "What do you mean the glove?" "Mitt Romney, the glove, Mitt, the glove."
Oh, it was a pun. Oh, thank you for that insight, Carl. Very insightful.
Really?
Bob Hines. Or no, actually, you know what? I'm going to go to the voice of fact and reason, Alan Moore. Alan, I mean, seriously, this is going to be something we've all said, who sucks less? It looks like the Obama camp is sucking a lot less than the Romney camp right now. Can the Romney camp recover without a major flub, fall down, major incident that might affect the Obama camp?
Especially, there's 48 or 49 days left. A lot of things can happen. They can happen domestically. More importantly, they can happen in the world.
Debates.
People vote for candidates, and they vote against candidates, and they choose not to participate. And all of those factors come into play in the handful of states that are going to make the difference. The Romney suffers from an enthusiasm factor. In terms of people being for him, there aren't that many people who say, "Oh yeah, he's really our guy." Obama's got a big core of people who say, "We still love him," and he's also got a big core of people who say, "We still hate him. We don't love Mitt, but we really hate Obama." The question is, okay, is anybody? How are things going to turn at the end? Are they going to say, I'm going to hold my nose and vote for this one, or am I going to hold my nose and vote for that one? And that group in the middle and a handful of states, it's too soon to tell. As Al says, the debates are going to be more important this year than they sometimes have been. They may end up making no difference, but if somebody comes out of the debates, and the debates probably can help Romney more than they would help Obama, if Romney can do reasonably well face-to-face, because now people are wondering, is this guy even up to the job, given some of the gaffes he has spoken, and people kind of know Obama, they don't know Romney that well, so he's got a lot more to gain and plenty to lose.
Right. Well, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to go to Tell Me a Story. My favorite part of the show, where we talk about the latest innuendo rumor that we hear around politics here in D.C. This is Backroom Politics Live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. We will be back in 2 minutes. Stay with us. You know, you hear us talk about Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. It's being the place to be. America's premier cigar tavern, place to make new friends or visit old friends, or even have a lively political discussion like we do here on Backroom Politics. But what you may not know, Shelley's is the place for private parties. Shelley's Backroom is available to host events for groups of 10 to 250. From cocktail receptions to sit-down dinners, Shelley's can provide custom menu options to suit your needs and budget. Although Shelley's is a smoke-friendly environment, Shelley's can make accommodations for non-smokers based on the side of your party, but heck, why would you want to? With a cigar menu like they have here, why would you even consider going smoke-free? Event pricing varies based on the time of the day of the week chosen for your event. For more information on private parties at Shelley's Back Room, go to www.shellysbackroom.com/private-party. Shelly's Back Room, the place to be, as Bob likes to say it. It's also the place for private parties. Walk away being friends and still have some respect for each other.
The whole purpose of our little organization is that people ought to be able to sit down and express their views and disagree and still be friends.
Right, which we do a lot. Today was very, very, very vocal.
I guarantee, unless Justin says something untoward again. We will do that again tonight after this program.
You guys will. I'm going home. I'm going to bed. This is my favorite part of the show. It is
with home.
Al Swift
with his cold.
Al Swift. Yeah, going back to bed with my cold. Al Swift. Anyway, this is my favorite part of the story, or my favorite part of the show. Favorite part of the show. Telling you a story where we talk about innuendo. Rumor and all the good things happening around D.C. Carson, now tell me a story.
You had to pick on me first. This is the part of the program that I hate most.
All right, I'll go around to you. Alan Moore, tell me a story,
all right,
please.
All right, two historic events this week.
Facts.
Here it comes.
Number one, here in Washington, D.C., a brand new single mom led to rejoicing by politicians from all parties. The giant panda, the National Zoo,
yes,
gave birth.
Yes,
so that's yes. The first one.
What's the next one?
Second one, I think Google broke some search records this week. People looking for those topless photos of Kate Middleton, the future Queen of England. Big news at Google for all those searches.
I'll tell you, I was one to
okay.
Five
oh,
searches like
I'm
that.
Not
yeah.
Asking people to vote,
yeah.
You know, records
she's
broken.
A pretty woman, I mean, my God.
And then the pivot from those historic events, Al and I were talking a little earlier about how world events can come to play and affect an election at the end. There's an unresolved issue still floating around about Libya. The Libyan government says, we gave 3 days notice to American counterparts that there was some risk of an incident at the consulate in Benghazi. Nothing seemed to have happened. Susan Rice, the representative to the UN from the United States, said, nope, we have no notice. Congress is going to look into this in a kind of a hurry-up basis. This is the kind of thing where, obviously, this tragedy was horrible, but if there is some kind of evidence that the U.S. government dropped the ball, that's the kind of thing that could have an impact on a presidential campaign.
An interesting point. Bob Hines, tell me a story.
Well, to follow up on that, we have three presidential debates, the first on the, I believe it is the 4th of October, 3rd of October,
right.
About 10 days out. I think given the recent mixes, the problems that Mr. Romney has had, with respect to foreign policy questions, I think the first debate, which is going to be on foreign policy, the second one on domestic policy, and the third a free-for-all, I think the first one may very well be the defining moment of the campaign.
You think so?
It's a
very interesting. Interesting. Carl Tubin, tell me a story.
I'm going to go back all the way to...
Is it in this decade?
No.
Okay. Go ahead.
Years ago.
Carl isn't in this decade. What are you talking about?
Most of us aren't either.
Some of us, well, that's true. That's true.
I'm older than Carl, so you're right.
Older than
Carl, me. Go ahead. Tell me a story.
At the peace conference at the end of World War I.
Oh, jeez, you're going deep in the pots, Carl.
I'm not that old.
And you were there.
Yes, I was.
In a trench.
They had to cut off the Balkans, and they made different countries. And a group from the State Department arrived at the place where President Wilson was staying and asked to come in and talk to him. And they argued that because of the religious divides, in years to come, was going to cause a lot of trouble. And of course, then he didn't listen. He said, that's to be worried then. And of course, when Yugoslavia was Yugoslavia and they had Tito, it wasn't a problem. As soon as Tito died, and it broke up, and then we had Kosovo, we had all this fighting. And it was tribal. Much of it was tribal. When we went into Iraq, we had the same situation. We had different tribes, Shiites and the others, and we knew that we were doing that. And it fell apart. And you have the same situation in a lot of these countries.
Okay.
In the Middle East.
Right.
And that's part of the reason why we're having this problem.
Okay. Yeah. Ralph, tell me a story.
Yes. As our viewers know, I was in Uzbekistan last week attending a small business conference sponsored by the government of Uzbekistan. President Ismail Karimov, a former Soviet official, has made the calculated decision that Russia is moving towards a totalitarian state and is definitely seeking U.S. Strategic military economic support.
Oh, wow.
Moving their system towards the small business and promotion.
Good intel. Now, tell me a story.
As we waded through the Republican primary and go back a couple of times to go through the Democratic primaries, both parties have had the problem. The reforms that were insisted upon largely by the liberals, and even the Republicans finally had to come along with it, under the theory that they had to let more of the public's view in. That was the theory behind it. Basically took the ability to make the key decisions in the party policy and in the selection of the candidates away from those who were the regular Democrats and the regular Republicans. That is what has brought us to this point. Under the old system, the Tea Party would not have had a chance. Under the old system, before George McGovern changed it, George McGovern wouldn't have been the presidential candidate. And all of history would be different. We need to get back to where the party has some greater strength, not dictatorial, but some greater strength than it has in current day politics.
Interesting. Alan Moore, real quick.
One quick fact.
Uh-oh, here we go.
It's the end of the day. The subject in the first debate 2 weeks from tomorrow in Denver is domestic policy.
Not foreign policy.
Not foreign policy.
Okay, good thing at factchecker.com. By the way, I have a story. The word is coming out of Las Vegas that the NFL's lockout of the officials is now hurting Vegas business. People are afraid to bet on any of the games in the regular season because they can't tell what the officiating is going to do. And it is now getting to a point that Vegas bookies are now, the book at the big casino houses are losing money. Therefore, there is going to be a push from the Vegas casinos and other casino operators here in the country to get the NFL and Roger Goodell to get off the stick and make something happen. little piece of intel for you.
Right.
That's what Tell Me a Story is about. World War One, and God even knows what you were talking about.
He was pointing at me. I want you to know.
The interesting thing is, if they don't solve this problem, someone is going to get killed. Really hurt. Out there.
There's been a lot of talk that the officiating has been so bad. You know, if you're here in Washington, you even remotely watch any second of the Washington Redskins St. Louis Rams game, you saw their two big defensive players get hurt. Arakpo's out for the rest of the season now.
So is Kerrigan.
And so is Kerrigan. It is a big problem. And again, somebody will probably get hurt. There's going to be money influence involved, and I think Vegas is going to step in and go to Roger Goodell. That's the word we're hearing from Vegas. So on behalf of Al Swift, Alan Moore, Bob, Bob Hines, Carl Tubin, Ralph Whitty, I'm your host, Justin Ross. Yes, Al.
And before you say goodbye, we all do hope that you get better soon.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. I hope I get better soon, too. I hope I get better
I know it was unanimous.
Right. Thank you. It was unanimous. I'm your moderator, a very sick moderator, Justin Russell. I'm going home. I'm going to bed. We'll see you next Tuesday here on Blog Talk Radio here at Backroom Politics at Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C.
The place to be.
That's right, folks. Join us next week, same time, same channel. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you. Thank you.